And welcome to the Climate Minute, your source for insight and perspective on global warming news. My name is Ted McIntyre, and this show is for the week of May 1st, 2022. Well, recently I've had the pleasure of being the guest on someone else's podcast. So the next several episodes of the Climate Minute will be cross-postings from a digital media site called Franklin Matters. Specifically, I've been talking to a guy named Steve Sherlock. He uses blogs and podcasts to help people in the small Massachusetts town that we both live in, the small Massachusetts town, to learn about town meetings and community events and all kinds of good stuff. In an age where small town newspapers are dying, this is a great model for the future. Since the impact of climate change go from the very global to the very local, Steve and I have been trying to make sense of what is happening in climate policy here in Massachusetts, especially as it pertains to the state's new climate roadmap, right? The next generation roadmap. That roadmap for climate policy is now enshrined into law, but as a state, we need to implement policies to achieve those goals. Conversations Steve and I have are mostly about the ups and downs of the process of implementing the roadmap. So today we're going to listen to the first of those shows that was posted in January of 2022. I hope you enjoy it.
Franklin Matters Radio Show. This session of the radio show shares my conversation with Ted McIntyre. We recorded this via Zoom Conference Bridge on Thursday, January 20, 2022. We cover the following topics within the realm of climate change. We start discussing some of the 12 points of the mass legislation passed in 2021. Along the way, we define some key terms: greenhouse gas, net zero, environmental justice, and geo-micro-district. As we did not get to all the points of the legislation, stay tuned. We'll schedule at least another session to continue this discussion. The recording runs about 38 minutes, so let's listen into my conversation about climate with Ted McIntyre. All right, Steve Sherlock here for Franklin Matters, Franklin Public Radio, WFPR.FM, anywhere on the internet, and 102.9 here in the local Franklin, Mass area FM dial. Here for a session today to talk about climate and a variety of topics within that realm, Ted McIntyre. Ted, welcome. Happy Thursday.
Hey, great to be here, Steve. Thanks for having me on.
Now, you and I go back a bit in time because we've been meeting here and there around climate at a variety of folks, variety of ways, meetings, events, et cetera. But for somebody who doesn't know Ted McIntyre, tell us a little bit about your story so that they'll have some way to frame, oh, yeah, this guy's legit, as opposed to, oh, I don't want to listen to him.
Well, that's a good thing to do. So I arrived in Franklin in 1994. Right. So I'm almost a full citizen now after almost 30 years.
After due diligence.
After due diligence. Now I'm a Franklin-er. My background is in physics. And in fact, nuclear particle physics. And I spent most of my career studying or making equipment to help manufacture computer chips.
Okay.
All the things that are used by Intel or Samsung to make your cell phone, that was
the semiconductor world, so to speak.
Semiconductor world, yes. And so there you go. My sort of mental stance towards the world is one of a physicist, right? Mm-hmm. You know there's stuff going on, there's energy transfer. You see the world in a different way when you think like a physicist. And that's just, for better or worse, that's the way it is.
Right.
One of the topics that had always Well, not always, but had intrigued me was this idea of climate change. So if you think back in the late 80s, there was a NASA guy who came and said that we had potential, Jim Hansen, right? Potential for climate change. But one question that is, why would that have caught me in 1988? Mm-hmm. And prior to that, I mean, I think that as a kid, I grew up in New Bedford, Massachusetts, right? And New Bedford is subject, historically, it's been subject to hurricanes, right?
True.
And then, so the great hurricane of 38, yada, yada. When I was a kid, these were all sort of vital stories about the threat. And it sort of taught you that nature was real and could do significant damage in a short amount of time.
Yes.
And we spent a lot of time at the waterfront, the beach. You saw bad things happening. Yeah. And I think that was tied up at the same time, at least in my upbringing, with the threat of nuclear war. Again, how humans could essentially devastate the planet.
Mm-hmm.
This is sort of heavy-duty stuff. But you say, okay,
sure,
all that's in your background. All of a sudden, somebody comes along, respected guy, says, oh, yeah, we are, in fact, screwing up the planet. And we have the ability to do that. And me, as a physicist, says, yeah, I can see those things that sort of at play. I mean, those processes are real. Funny, at that point, I started to get worried about it. But my boss, also a physicist, looked at me and said, nah, it's all statistics. Forget it. They don't know what they're talking about. So I, okay. So I put the whole thing back in a box for about 10 years. And then in the late 1990s, I was, again, worried about it. And I had this new shiny new thing called a computer on my desk. I could go to websites. I could surf the internet. And I was convinced that I was the only guy out there who knew about climate change and the only guy looking at, I mean, one of the things about being a physicist, I guess I would say, is that you deal in orders of magnitude much more easily than most people, right? You know, there's a thousand, there's a million, there's a billion, right? A billion years is a lot different from 1,000 years, right? So these timescales and are not so scary. And you get to see that, you can see that the things people are talking about that are going to happen on 100 or 1,000 year time frame, that's real. That's going to happen. I mean, we did a podcast one time that said we should not be saying that the date of our year is 2022. It should be 02022. I mean, we should be thinking in terms of a 10,000 year calendar, right? Not a 1,000 year calendar, because those timescales are real. Anyway, I was the only guy who thought I saw the end of the world coming. And then in the early 2000s, I got connected up with an organization that was similar, inspired by civil rights actions in the 1950s, where people would. So basically, the deal was you come to the organization, you bring a presentation on climate change, they help you polish it up and make it nice, and then you promise to give it in 10 different places. Very, very similar to what Al Gore did starting around 2009. But I mean, this idea of committing, for me, it was a revelation that there were other people who shared my same fears. Right. And as part of that, I was able to connect with a local nonprofit called the Massachusetts Climate Action Network, which was actually trying to do something about the problem in cities and towns. And that has been, you know, a life sustainer for me for thinking about what is becoming. I mean, everyone knows, everyone hears the 10 biblical plagues that are going to come upon us, right? So we don't have to go, I mean, this is serious stuff. And for me, it has, it's given me some sense of a way to avoid despair. I say, I'm doing something, right? I'm thinking about this. And so there you go.
There's a couple of ties there for sure. And I go back even to my early days. I grew up in Pawtucket, Rhode Island. And I was walking across the Division Street Bridge. People may recognize that. I'm going into downtown to the Boys Club. And there was a boardwalk, literally boards on the sidewalk. Occasionally they would crack, there'd be a hole in it. So as young boys, we would take stones and drop them down into the river. And the river at the time, this was in the early 60s, so it was pre-EPA, was completely sud covered. That was the Blackstone River. And because all the industry along the Blackstone River, by the time it got to that point before hit into Providence. It was completely suds covered. So the game was, can we drop a big enough rock so we can see the water underneath?
Really? Really?
Yeah. And that was my intro, at least into industrial pollution.
You don't probably realize at the time, but that's like a little time bomb ticking away in your head. And when you get enough perspective on life, you say, holy mackerel, what was that all about, right?
Now, fortunately, through EPA, things have cleaned up. So now I can walk across the bridge. There's no suds. It's cleaner. I'm not sure I'd go swimming in it yet. But supposedly it is cleaner. There is fish returning, et cetera. So that's all good. But at least had that perspective. So now when I hear you and others, and clearly living anywhere today, the weather has certainly gotten much more elaborate, much more extreme. Something indeed is going on. So really, we're changing this. It's staggering. So that's why I figured. Well,
it's has typically been a hoop to jump through, is that most people are convinced that humans are not sufficiently powerful to change nature. Right. And you can ramp off into all kinds of discussion of theology and whatnot about, you know, is it possible? And it takes a shift in consciousness to say, yeah, humans have reached a point where we can do, you know, geological damage in geological time, right? Mm-hmm. Damage on the scale of thousands to millions of years that it takes to recover. And, you know, we are gods of our own creation. Right?
Mm. And for obviously with the pandemic and other things, if people don't accept science, and that's one issue, if people don't understand statistics and math, that's another issue. Because, oh yeah, when you look back at the charts, and clearly people can, what was that other saying that, you know, data doesn't lie, but you can make the data say almost whatever you want to say. The charts, the real charts, clearly show something is happening. There was a chart, you know, where the temperature has been just astronomically growing. And oh, by the way, more specifically in the last 20, 30, 40 years than at any time in our recorded history. Now, again, to your point, it's only 2000 years that we as humans are looking at. But there's things that can go back further than that, that now we're starting to build some technology to actually figure out. Oh,
it is so cool. I mean, this is where I kind of geek out. And when I should say that when I started talking about climate to people and trying to communicate, I was convinced that if I could just explain how the infrared radiation interacts with the carbon dioxide molecule, everyone would get it. And we'd all do the right thing. That hasn't worked out so well, but you're touching on a fascinating point. I mean, you say, how can they know what the temperature was 800,000 years ago, right? Mm-hmm. 800,000 years ago. I mean, that's a long, long time. And they have these, they do what's called an ice. So they go to the South Pole where the ice has been getting layered and layered and layered from every year a new snowstorm comes in, puts down, and all that stuff gets slowly packed down. Mm-hmm. But if you're smart and you're a scientist, you go and you basically drill a hole in this thing and you get this column of ice that goes down to the bottom of, and then you slice that like a bologna, and each mm-hmm. little slice of the ice, you can, again, you can just look at the bubbles of CO2 in that, right, and tell you how much there was. And it's fantastically accurate. And so they can recreate this stuff. And yeah, I mean, it's science that you and I are never going to do, right? No, or maybe understand how to produce.
We don't have that equipment,
don't have the training of the time, but it's real. And it's very interesting stuff. Very interesting stuff that they can, you know, between tree rings, that they can match up tree rings then to the ice data. And anyway, it's very interesting stuff. And yes, to your point, it's all very credible. No one is, you know, there's not some scientist somewhere driving a Rolls Royce because of the big grant he got to study tree rings. I mean, it just doesn't happen that way. I mean, that's not the situation.
Not at all. So one other piece, clearly, I think, for anybody in mass, at least last year, there was a significant level of conversation around climate action, and the House and the Senate had put together the package. The governor finally signed it. So hooray. Yeah. But we're not done yet, right? There's a whole lot of work to be done. Just legislation was just one start.
Well, I want to talk about the legislation because there's a lot of good stuff in it. But I think it's important for people to realize that we, in quotation marks, we as a species, humans, we're embarking on what amounts to a 100-year journey. Right? It's going to take us 100 years to get to some place where the climate might be stable and that we've transitioned away from fossil fuel. Right. Mm-hmm. We've got systems in place where the planet's stable again. That's 100 years. So we have to have sort of a commitment that outlasts our lives, probably our children's lives. Right. Yeah. But so there's this very long timeline about what we're going to do. And that's embodied in this roadmap, which then brings it back to very specific things that we do now. What do they say? Journey of 1,000 miles begins with a single step. Right. Right now, there's the roadmap that, as you say, was not very popular in the governor's office, but he finally signed up to it, right? And there's this big, it's more than a vision, right? Because there's specific things in the roadmap that have to happen, but it is also a visionary statement that there will have to be additional legislation, additional work, ongoing work to achieve the goals that are set out in this roadmap bill, right? So that's sort of the tension back and forth, right? And but it's a very good bill. And so let's just talk through some of the bigger points in the bill. Can I do
absolutely,
that?
Absolutely. My seatbelt is on. I'm ready for this ride.
Well, this is important. So it is important to avoid jargon, because a lot of this stuff quickly descends into stuff that only the insiders know what the heck you're talking about. Mm-hmm. And then everyone else's eyes glaze over because you don't want to be there. This is
as an English major, I'll help you work with that, because if you use a term I'm not sure of, or I don't think somebody's sure of, it's like, what was that?
Absolutely. Absolutely. The, I guess the first and sort of main takeaway of the roadmap, of which is like 12, we're not going to get through all 12.
No, the first, we'll have to come back for that.
We'll have to come back. But the first big thing is that the state set goals for itself, right? Irrespective of the federal government, Rhode Island, whatever, we set a goal for ourselves that we would cut our greenhouse gas emissions. So what is a greenhouse gas? Already, first buzzword, right? Yep. A greenhouse gas is any of these gases that contribute to global warming. And what those greenhouse gases do is they hang around in the air for a long, 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 long time and basically trap heat. What happens is it bounces the heat from the sky back down to the earth. Mm-hmm. And the way to translate it, the way to think about it, is that everyone knows that on a hot, humid day, right? On a humid day, things get hot, right?
Yes. Yep.
And that on a cold, cold winter night, the sky is completely clear.
Sure.
Right? Sure. Right. So the idea here is that the water vapor is also a greenhouse gas, right? Which comes and goes. It's not a very important greenhouse, but it is a greenhouse gas. So on those humid days, it tends to get hotter underneath the water, right? The CO2 in these other greenhouse gases are very similar. And conversely, on a cold, clear winter's night, there's no water vapor in the air. And so all the heat escapes. Yep. And that
there's no blanket to hold it in, so to speak.
Except for now, we're putting more and more CO2 up there. So even on a cold winter's night, the CO2 is sort of acting like a little cloud cover trapping the heat. Anyway, so greenhouse gas, we're trying to reduce that. Where do the greenhouse gases come from? Mostly it's from something called carbon dioxide, which comes from burning things. Almost anything you burn, in particular, natural gas to heat your home, gas to drive your car, that makes carbon dioxide, which is a greenhouse gas. The state says, nay, 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 no more of that stuff. Mm-hmm. Okay? So we're going to encounter another, this is just the first, but I mean, the first buzzword is that the state says we are going to have net zero carbon emissions by the year 2050. Right, so you're already talking 30 years from now, 28 years now, to be specific, but you're already talking half a century kind of time scale achieve these things, right? And they said, we're going to be net zero. So it turns out that net zero carbon emissions is an ambiguous phrase that's defined in different ways. But for the state, for the purposes of this document, net zero emissions means net, you're going to look at how much you've emitted, how much of these greenhouse gases you've emitted, and how much you took out of the air.
Actually removed.
Removed. And maybe you do that by planting a tree, okay, which has its own moral hazard.
But, natural absorptions, et cetera.
Yeah. So when you net those things out, we're going to be zero by 2050, right? So that's a nice promise. The reason I bring up trying to specify this idea of net zero carbon emissions is also a easy way for the people in power to dodge a bullet. Because you can always say, oh, yeah, in 2040, we're going to plant the whole forest in Franklin, right? And we're just going to capture all the CO2 that we emitted in 2022, and everything's going to be So because the people who framed the roadmap are pretty savvy, they also put in a secondary requirement, right? That said, and I'll just quote, the secondary requirement said that by 2030, the actual absolute emissions of these greenhouse gases, the carbon dioxide, the emissions have to be reduced by 50% compared to where we are now.
So we've actually got some milestone before we get there. We just can't wait till the last minute and do something. We've got to do something in order. Yeah.
And it's not a net thing. It's the absolute emissions go down.
Mm-hmm.
Right. So it sort of covers this loophole of the net zero thing.
Right.
By 2040, it has to be 75%. Right. Yep. So that's good. Right. Because those are real. It's going to be really hard.
Those are aggressive.
Yeah. And so it's so fascinating. This is where it spins off into all kinds of other immediate things. One of the ways the state has told itself that it is going to achieve these greenhouse gas emissions is by reducing pollution from electricity generation. And the way it's going to reduce that carbon pollution from electricity generation is by importing electricity from a place called Hydro-Québec. So up in northern Quebec, there are all these hydroelectric dams making huge amounts of electricity.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
Completely greenhouse free. Again, everything has a caveat. I mean, it's destructive to Quebec to have all these dams and whatnot, but put that aside for a minute. We say, okay, Massachusetts says, we're going to import all this great green electricity, and that's going to get us to our goal. And they say, the way we're going to do this, we're going to build a power line through New Hampshire and bring all that electricity into Massachusetts through New Hampshire. And about 2 years ago, everybody in New Hampshire said, no, you cannot build that power line in our town, right? Big surprise.
That sounds like NIMBY, not in my backyard, doesn't it?
Not in my forest. Okay. And so then Massachusetts said, fine, New Hampshire, we don't need you. We're going to go to Maine. We're going to build a power plant from Quebec through Maine.
Maine's bigger, more space.
Last November, the people in Maine voted to reject the second electric. So that puts Massachusetts in a quandary. Is how are we going to achieve these goals of reductions? And so now this is me talking. We say, okay, Massachusetts, what we need to do is to build a heck of a lot more solar panels and wind turbines, right? Mm-hmm. So we don't have an option to sort of say, oh, let's change the commitment, right? We have to make that commitment. So this is very interesting. My point being that there's like real live politics happening right now as we speak about how we're going to achieve these goals in 2030, 2050. Lots of conversations about it. Okay. So there you go. A second related thing that's good in this roadmap is that in order to hold ourselves accountable, the bill says that there are six specific areas of the economy that need to have their greenhouse gases reduced. Right. And they're subtotaled. Right. So you can't say, oh, my emissions from houses went way up, but my emissions from cars went down and it's all all cool.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
It says each one has to go down. And those areas are things like electricity generation, transportation, residential buildings, et cetera, et cetera. So it's all really, really good stuff.
Right.
And it sets Massachusetts on a path to generate a lot more electricity here in the state. And what you see is that, there is there is something called Vineyard Wind, which is, yes, has been proposed and recently approved to go ahead by the Biden administration. It's going to be off the coast of Nantucket.
Right.
This is really a good thing, right? And this is the first tranche of several big wind projects. But that Vineyard Wind thing directly connects back to this roadmap. I mean, sure. How are we going to get this right?
Yeah, so just to clarify, instead of getting the electricity from Hydro-Québec via some pipeline transmission line, we would get the electricity generated from the windmills offshore and thereby closer, much more in our control.
Right, except with the further explanation that they're still trying to get the main transmission line put in place, right? And so there's so much tight, so there's a lot of flux. But this is, in my humble opinion, the simple way is to give people in the state of Massachusetts jobs installing solar panels and wind turbines, right? Mm-hmm. Why should we send our money to Canada to have them run a hydro dam, right? Let's just do it here. But sure. Then you're into much more nitty gritty politics. But it's, if you like that kind of stuff, it's happening now, right? Mm-hmm. Another thing that this roadmap talks about is environmental justice. So what's environmental justice? Mm-hmm. This is another code word, right? And it pertains to the fact that there's this iron law of politics is that the least politically powerful get the worst stuff in their communities. Mm-hmm. Right. If the utility wants to build a power plant, it does not go to Wellesley. Right. It goes somewhere with less political power and builds the power plant there. Mm-hmm. And as part and parcel of this big transition we're talking about, we need to have environmental justice standards so that the people in the communities that are least powerful can speak against things that might be put into their communities. Mm-hmm. Because we have common ground, right? Because again, there's this concept you got to keep in mind that every time some new fossil fuel power plant or pipeline is built, that's what's called infrastructure. And that the timeline for the financial payoff of that infrastructure is 50 to 70 years, mm-hmm. right? 70 years from now is 2092, right? Well past the time that we have to be. So all of this new infrastructure is bad. They're trying to put it into communities that don't have the political capability to oppose it. And so those people need to be given that just on a moral basis. They need mm-hmm. to be given the right. So there's the environment there. Improve definitions of what environmental justice means, what it means to be an environmental justice community. Right. And there are examples. You may have heard that in Weymouth, they're trying to put compressor. A pipeline thing, the Weymouth compressor. Mm-hmm. There is a peaker plant in Peabody that they're trying to put
which
in.
Already has two of them, and this is supposedly a third.
Oh, it's
which proves your point that they keep going where they've got little political say, and well, there's already one there. You can use another one.
So the mindset, for example, 2 or 3 years ago, or even more than that, Governor Baker went to Weymouth, right? And he was questioned about Weymouth. And he said, he had the nerve to say, well, Weymouth is not exactly virgin territory, right? So that's the mindset where the environmental justice community says, okay, just because I had this thing stuck on me before, I don't need I don't need to be continue to be burned.
Right.
And so there's huge questions about how to fairly roll out who gets the wind turbine, who gets the solar panel, right? Again, it's very interesting stuff. If you have any sort of, I don't know, I mean, it's very interesting, very interesting.
Yeah. Sure.
So let me keep the other thing. So there's another thing that we probably are marching along with a lot of time. I hope I'm not going too high a word count, there's another very, very interesting aspect. And this very interesting aspect pertains to the place that I volunteer, right? My little part of the world with Massachusetts Climate Action Network. So here's the deal. In Massachusetts, a significant portion of our greenhouse gases that are emitted, our greenhouse gas emissions, come from homes, right? is the emissions from cooking your cook stove where you're cooking with gas. I have to admit, my clothes dryer is gas. We have natural gas to heat our home here, right? Mm-hmm. So all those things create carbon dioxide emissions.
I have an oil furnace to heat the house. So that's in that realm.
All these things. And the question is, if by 2030, if the residences account for something like 20 or 30% of our emissions, how are we going by 2030 to get rid of all that? That means by 2030, every house, you know, something like 50% of the houses in the state have to be running on heating themselves using electricity.
And so or something other than fossil fuel.
Or something other than fossil fuels. And this is where you'll hear, again, these are all these buzzwords floating around, but you'll hear this thing that says electrify everything. Right? That means that your home, in your home, you have an induction cooktop instead of gas, right? Mm-hmm. In the basement, you have what's called a heat pump. Now, a heat pump sounds kind of scary because how can you pump heat, right? But you already have a heat pump. It's called a refrigerator. Right, your refrigerator is pumping the heat out of the inside of the refrigerator and putting it all on that radiator that gets dusty behind your on the other side of the refrigerator,
the wall,
right?
Which you never see until you move to paint the wall, etc.
Exactly, and you know you should go in once in a while and vacuum that stuff off because it makes you yada yada yada. But something like a heat pump, there are heat pumps. The technology has improved so much that this is a legitimate, cheap way to heat a home in Massachusetts. And we need to think about how to do that. To that end, you get into this really incredibly sexy thing about building codes. People just love talking about building codes, right? It's not. People don't want to think about building codes. But between now and 2030, all new buildings should be built 100% electrified. Mm-hmm. Right? Because that building is going to be there in 2050, if not way past that. And right. So it has to be electrified. And so the challenge for the state is, and for the Massachusetts Climate Action Network, is how do we get building codes that recognize the need? Right. So there's all this talk about something called the net zero building code.
Right. So that's beyond, there are, I think it's LED. I've seen in business buildings, there are certain LED qualifications where because of their glass infrastructure, whatever the structure is, that they're quote greener, they're probably not net zero, which I think to your point would get to that next level and then to the building code. So the building code has the specifications for the rising of the steps, the placement of the outlets and windows, et cetera. But we'd have to get into that next level that whatever is powering the house is, quote, greener than the fossil fuels.
And in fact, you may have seen that in the town of Brookline, over the past couple of years, Brookline went so far as to ban natural gas hookups for new construction.
Mm. Okay. Right.
So that ran into some static with the attorney general's office because they said, oh, the towns can, you know, town versus state rules, blah, blah, blah. But that's the concept. You say, okay, if you build a new building, you can't put gas in it. Full stop. Right. Yep. But then there's this other fascinating thing. And this is, again, comes back to questions of environmental justice. If you think of a place like New Bedford, my beloved hometown, full of triple deckers, probably built in 1910 or so, right? Out of stick and wood, not very well insulated, right? Mostly with, well, not mostly, but potentially a lot of renters, right? That carbon dioxide is real too, right? So how is the state going to get in, retrofit all those places? And that is this huge nut that has to be cracked, right? Because there's so much carbon dioxide that comes from residential places. There's such a need for retrofitting. All of the big gateway cities in Massachusetts, right, need enormous. And of course, the flip side is that there's a lot of jobs there.
Yes. Right? Somebody still has to do that work.
Somebody still has to do that. So it's a win-win, right? Which, so anyway, MCAN is pushing for these net zero building codes. And here, now, before we talked about net zero as kind of a scam, in this instance, net zero means that you either you're electrified, but whatever energy you don't produce with solar panels on your roof, you buy renewable energy certificates for, right?
Okay.
So it's a slightly different definition of net zero, but still, this is something that needs, and what happens is under the roadmap bill signed by the governor, the state is obligated to offer a net zero building code option.
Mm-hmm.
Right, as part of the state regulations of what building codes are, and it's very interesting because the Baker administration is pushing for something called a high efficiency building code.
Mm-hmm.
Right, so the silver tongue devil's everywhere. Right,
the variation on a theme.
Well, a high efficiency building code would be a nicely sealed, very efficient, high resistive value, good windows on your house, but still a gas burner in the basement. Right. Which is like, okay, that just doesn't cut it.
No.
So anyway, there's a ton of stuff. The other interesting thing, and again, this is a Mass Climate Action Network topic, is something called municipal light plants. So having grown up in New Bedford, I know that Taunton has its own municipal light plant. What does that mean? Well, the town of Taunton does not get its electricity from NSTAR, Eversource. Right,
it National is Grid own or whoever.
Little
yeah.
utility, right? Yep. And there are something like 41 of these little utilities spread around the state.
There are, yeah, I've heard there's a number of them. Yep,
and they represent something like 14% of the carbon emissions come from those utilities.
Mm-hmm.
And so, what these new roadmap bill does is to say, oh yeah, in the past, the MLP, the municipal light plants, have been sort of orphan child, right? Who don't get called into anything. The roadmap says, oh no, you guys also have to live with the same greenhouse gas rules and how your emissions have to drop same way everyone else.
Mm-hmm. And they're within the scope.
Within the scope. And the Mass Climate Action Network is helping those MLPs do the right thing.
Mm-hmm.
So So anyway, there's more. There's a ton more stuff in there. But
I think that's a good point that at this point, you know, before everybody else's head starts really spinning too much, you've elucidated, I think it was three key pieces. And there's more. I think you said, 10 or 12 points?
Yeah, 10 or 12 points the article is a very easy to read one. So you can put that in the show notes.
That in the show notes. Yep. Because then I know there's a related conversation around certainly to the heat pump. I spent some time in Iceland last year. They're completely green in terms of their electrical. And I think it's 70% of theirs comes from geothermal. Which is related to the heat pump piece because you can get the heat, obviously, at 50 degrees if you go down far enough, which can then help foster that. But okay, then there's this other concept that's coming along, and in a conversation with Rep. Ryan, I know, and his new role with the TUE committee, he's at some of that forefront between the wind, tackling some of these other pieces. And at some point, I think it's Mass Save is going to be doing audits and helping individual homeowners to start making these, you know, changes, because clearly somebody's going to have to make the change at some point.
Well, it's very interesting. So there's one other sort of big concept you can sink your teeth into. If you imagine a world where each house is running on a heat pump, right? Mm-hmm. And you say, we can't do this one by one, right? You can't do it house by house. You have to do it by a neighborhood. There's this idea that says, and further, that your heat pump works better, is even more efficient or costs less to run if you use geothermal, this 50 degree water that comes if you dig down 100 feet, mm-hmm. you get this constant. They say, okay, fine. The gas company, what used to be the gas company and has pipes in the street, now is in charge of pumping water at 50 degrees pipes into your home. So now you have this grid, it's called a geo micro district, where the utility is providing you constant temperature water to make your heat pump work better. And it's done at a neighborhood scale. So it has the sort of scope of saying, yeah, maybe if we did that, we could get to our 2030 goal of millions of homes. It's really an interesting idea.
Talk about leveraging the infrastructure that's already there. Because that's,
guys,
it's already there. And now you're taking the bad stuff away, putting the good stuff through it. Hello, what's wrong with that?
It's magic, right? It keeps the utility in business because they are going to fight you if you try and put them out of business. All the people that fix the pipelines will keep their jobs. And in fact, you're going to need more people to do it.
Sure.
And you cut carbon pollution. Like,
right.
You know, what's not to like?
No. Well, to the extent that there's more to the story, we want to tease folks to come back as opposed to overwhelming them all at once.
Yeah. I apologize for.
No. This is good. This is good. So thank you for your time today. And yeah, we'll have to set up a time to continue this because I'm having fun and learning stuff along the way and able to share a few points that I picked up. And oh, yeah, that makes sense. That's where it works. Ooh.
In my experience, the penny doesn't drop until the third time I've heard something described to me. So the first two times, what the heck is that? And then the third time, oh, yeah, I heard about that somewhere. Uh-huh. So even just being exposed to the words is a good thing. And you don't need to understand it the first time, but eventually all of a sudden you'll say, oh, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
So there you go.
Absolutely. No, well, we'll include the terms we defined. So net zero.
Environmental justice. Geo-micro district. I mean, there's all kinds of
things. Yeah. So we'll create that terminology, which then will inform our language as we start talking with our neighbors. Hey, what are you doing in this case?
That's right.
Good. Well, thank you. And until next time, we do this because Franklin matters.
We are now producing this in collaboration with Franklin TV and Franklin Public Radio. This podcast is my public service effort for Franklin, but we can't do it alone. We can always use your help. How can you help? If you can use the information that you find here, please tell your friends and neighbors. If you don't like something here, please let me know. Through this feedback loop, we can continue to make improvements. And I thank you for listening. For additional information, please visit franklinmatters.org. If you have questions or comments, you can reach me directly at suresteve@gmail.com. The music for the intro and exit was provided by Michael Clark and the group East of Shirley. The piece is titled Ernesto Mañana, copyright Michael Clark and Tin Type Tunes in 2008, and used with their permission. I hope you enjoy. By the way, you can also subscribe and listen to Franklin Matters Radio on iTunes or your favorite podcast app. Search in podcasts for Franklin Matters.
Very cool.